Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome back to another week of Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to put them, the children, before us, the adults. I'm joined again this week by my executive director, Josh Wood. Josh, welcome to the weekend.
Hey, guys.
We're going to start off with some Bible time because that's how we like to start everything off. I've been going through Exodus, as you know, if you've been tuning in the last couple weeks, and I stumbled upon this very familiar passage about Moses, burning bush, and the conversation that he has with God about whether or not he is up for the task of what it is. And he's been through the process of like, okay, who are you? Okay, what do you want? And then he gets to the how to, right? What if they don't listen? And Moses says to God, suppose they don't believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say, the Lord hasn't appeared to you. Boy, you're crazy. The Lord didn't appear to you. So the Lord said to him, what's in your hand? And Moses said, a rod. So I just thought, this is so true. God seeks to use all of us for these big world-shaping missions. And very, very often, he does it with what is in our hand right now. I mean, obviously, this happens in the Bible all throughout. You've got like David using what's in his hand to fight Goliath. You've got, you know, Shamgar, who uses like an ox goad to like destroy his enemies. You've got five loaves and five fishes in the hand of a boy who's used to feed, you know, 5,000. And oftentimes what God does is he says, I am calling you to something great and I'm going to use what's in your hand. It looks very ordinary. It doesn't look very fancy. It doesn't look like a conventional weapon. But in God's hand, Moses's staff parts the Red Sea, is a symbolism of triumph when Israel prevails against their enemies. It's called the rod of God. It makes water come out of a rock. So this is actually true for you and me too. When God calls you to something great and world shaping, which he is, because that's what he does for everyone, he is going to do it using the things that are in your hand. What's in your hand? What is it that you're holding right now? I'll wager a guess that it's probably some of the greatest pains or struggles or challenges that you've gone through in your life. But you give that to God and you put it in his hand and it becomes this incredible weapon over which the enemy cannot overcome. So my encouragement to you today is you're probably thinking about ways where you need to step up and step in to some of the great battles, whether it's just in your family, whether it's in the culture at large, hopefully it is in some way on behalf of children. And I bet that God wants to use something in your hand, something personal you've gone through to do exactly that.
I love that, you know, we hear in the New Testament about Moses. He's in there, by the way. They talk about how he tried to do the work he was called to early as well, which is what got him sent to the wilderness, is that he almost did it on his own strength, his own timing, out of emotion. And it says they weren't ready to go with him. Mm-hmm. And now we see later in life, after a time in the wilderness, God's calling him to it and he's much more hesitant. So I do think it speaks to those people too, who we've been burned, we've tried and failed, we've crashed out. Maybe people have things on us. They're going to point to the ways in which we haven't lived up to these ideals in the past. All those kind of words in our ear, why we shouldn't be the one to do this. You know, this isn't just Moses lacking courage. He just knows what happened last time. Mm-hmm. And so I do think it's really important to remember, not only can God do great things if we allow him, submit what's in our hand, but also it's good to remember that this is all going to be in God's timing. Pray through. Whether it's a conversation with a coworker or a family member, pray through your moment and let God reveal to you, hey, this is the time. Hopefully it's as clear as a burning bush. I can't promise that. But hopefully God does reveal to you the moment and then be confident, like he shows Moses through this example, that I can make this happen with you, with whatever's in your hand, no matter how big the obstacle.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yep. We do need more of us that are ready to step up to the major challenges of this moment in history. And it's not for the paid activists and it's not for the government officials. It's for you and me and everyone with the ordinary things in our hands right now. We're going to cover some trending news now. There has been a lot going on that intersects with marriage and family, certainly reproductive technologies. And so let's talk a little bit about some of the big headlines that have been in the news this week.
Yeah, we've got a headline out of PBS. Vance assures media that Trump would veto a federal abortion ban. So before we dive in, let's just all remember where things stand currently. The famous case Roe v. Wade essentially gave abortion access to everyone. It was at the federal level, which existed above the states, and it said essentially that you cannot restrict the woman's right to abortion. Now, over time, that kind of became viability. Like you had to, if the baby could survive outside the womb, you couldn't perform an abortion then, and it stayed in the courts forever. There were all these fights. Now, where it stands post Dobbs, which was the next decision, is that it rests with the states, which allows for California to have a very different law than, say, Tennessee. So when asked about this, the question was, will we return to a federal mandate, the opposite of Roe? So where Roe mandated access to abortion, this proposed federal abortion ban would say it is illegal now, it is unconstitutional to provide access to an abortion, no matter if you're in California or Tennessee. So when candidate Vance was asked about that, Vance said, I can absolutely commit to vetoing an abortion ban. Katie, what do you think about that?
Well, unfortunately, it looks like a continuation of the slide that we are seeing from a Republican Party and certainly Republican candidates who in the past have been very clear on their pro-life stance. You know, we saw this, I really like J.D. Vance. I think that he's a good guy. I think he's a family man. I think he's incredibly smart and articulate. And in the past, he has been staunchly pro-life, an absolute ally in the fight for the unborn of our country. But he had an interview, leading up to his selection as a VP candidate, where he said, yeah, I'm okay with the abortion pill, which is the majority of abortions that take place in the country today. And then we saw the pro-life provisions stripped from the GOP platform. And you and I talked about this on the radio show. And now we're seeing them move farther and farther away from recognizing the preborn as having a right to life. I mean, J.D. Vance said this this week about vetoing a federal abortion ban, but also President Trump tweeted something about how he wants to protect reproductive rights. Now, I don't know what he means by that, but I'll tell you what, if he means what we think that he means, that means that he is now solidly on the pro-choice side of things. So what do we know? What do we do here? And the answer is, we don't make our determination. You know, as Christians, as conservatives, and certainly as people that stand on behalf of child protection, we don't determine our policies based on political convenience. We don't make those kinds of calculations of, I'm going to say this so I can win. There's no worth, there's no benefit of winning if it means that the smallest and most vulnerable among us are victimized. I mean, you might make a political calculation there, but it should never be at the expense of the most vulnerable. So this is not a palatable conversation right now. You know, even within the quote unquote safe camp of conservatives, Republicans, some Christians, but it doesn't matter. We don't make decisions based on whether or not we think we're going to win. We make decisions based on what is going to provide the ultimate level of protection for kids. And unfortunately, that means standing against some of what's coming out of the Republican Party right now.
Well, I think we would do so if you are a conservative and you feel compelled to still vote for Trump Vance, I do think you'll do yourself a service by at least admitting that this is not a good thing. Like we have to follow the truth wherever it takes us. And if fertilization begins life, that moment, then that is a life, whether it exists in California whether it exists in Tennessee, whether it is inside or outside of the womb. Life is life regardless of its location. And I don't think that doesn't preclude you from voting for Trump and Vance in this election, them saying that. But we should be able to say, hey, yeah, I think that was against my values. And I might still vote because I believe the alternative is worse. But what we can't do is see this decision and then try to somehow justify or change our values and put truth in subjection to this changing political wind. I think then people don't take us seriously as Christians. I think we got to be able to sit back, critique, and go, I think they really got this one wrong. I may still vote for you, but that was not a good thing. I do not agree with that. I will not support that.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I want to hit on another major news headline that did not get the kind of coverage that it deserved, certainly from the mainstream media. And that is what's happening to children who have come across the border. Josh, can you tell us a little bit about what was revealed this week about the fate of some of these unaccompanied minors?
Yep. I'll give you the summary real quick. So this was in the Federalist. It's the federal government loses track of up to 300,000 children who illegally cross the border. So the Department of Homeland Security's IG recently released a memo showing that the administration has lost track of potentially up to 300,000 children who illegally cross the border. 32,000 are unaccounted for. After being issued notices to appear in court, and the other 291,000 have yet to be issued these appearances for court. So they're just not sure yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So translation, we have probably lost maybe up to half of the kids that have come across the border. And, you know, our next segment, the reason why I wanted to hit on this briefly is our next segment, we are going to be interviewing Laura Reese at the Heritage Foundation. She wrote the border security and immigration chapter of our new book, Pro-Child Politics, Why Every Issue is a Every Cultural, Economic, and National Issue is a Matter of Justice for Children. And so when I saw these headlines, the reality is I wasn't surprised because I had read Laura's chapter. I had seen, she already laid out the way that children are being victimized in the most brutal way through our current border security and immigration policies. And so this revelation, it almost is like, you could have seen it coming. The way that we are processing, the way that we are welcoming children to come across without a parent invites this kind of abuse.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. This is, I do think to give people credit, I think border policy can sometimes have the most idealistic of intentions, that we can take everyone, we will welcome everyone, we will help everyone, and this great nation will assimilate everyone into, you know, loving families, they'll get jobs and things will go great. And I think, you know, a real point of contention is, where are the adults in the room to talk about the realities that we have made commitments to generations of Americans who are already here, who are poor and need help, who can occupy a limited number of spots, whether it's in vocational training schools or in, you know, housing shelters. And we, if there is one bed and two people, like, we got to remember, one person will not get the resource. We cannot print an unlimited amount of money, nor can we create an unlimited amount of shelters. We have to grapple with realities. And by lying to ourselves, we are creating this situation that we're in right now, where these 300,000 kids will just disappear, and they're going to hope it doesn't make the news, and the world doesn't get to see the consequences of our irresponsibility and unwillingness to tell the truth.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this headline brings into sharp reality that children are being victimized through our current immigration and border security policy. And that is why we want you, ordinary mom and dad, regular voter, everyday citizen, to start thinking about all major political issues through the lens of child protection, through the lens of justice for children. Why? Because they are. And this story, more than anything else, highlights that sickening, horrible fact. So we want you to think rightly about politics. Go grab a copy of Pro-Child Politics today. Get one for yourself, get one for your legislator, and let's start protecting kids.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to put them, the children, before us, the adults, in matters of marriage and family. But as you guys know, if you've been listening the last couple weeks, the other big project that we've had on our plate right now is an effort to take that put children first mindset into all of politics. And our next book, Pro Child Politics, seeks to do exactly that. So we have broadened our child protective lens beyond just marriage and family, even beyond social issues. And we've started to take on and really frame a lot of the economic and the national issues as matters of justice for children as well. We worked really hard to get this out before the election because we understand that you guys are making decisions about who to vote for. And a lot of that is going to come down to the big issues that we're facing. And what we're trying to do with pro-child politics is to say, all of these issues have something in common. And that is, when we get them wrong, children are victimized. So in this election, it was very important for us to have a chapter on border security and immigration. Other than the economy, it's probably the thing that concerns people the most. And so we invited Laura Reese at the Heritage Foundation to write our chapter on border security and immigration. So Laura is here joining me today. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Katie, for having me on and for spearheading this project.
Yeah, great. You know, I want to walk people through your chapter here. But first, just give us a little background, like, how did you get into this? And what's your background here in terms of like immigration policy?
So I have been working on immigration matters for about 28 years. I fell in love with the issue back in college. I just found it fascinating because so many factors affect immigration, whether that is, people migrate for economic reasons, for family reasons, for a whole host of reasons, political reasons, but also immigration then affects so many aspects of our lives here, whether it is our economy or our, education or crime or healthcare, et cetera. And it's just because it affects everyday Americans in so many aspects of our daily lives, it's just been at the forefront. And, the past 3.5 years are just off the charts.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I required every author to do is begin their chapter with the real life story of a child who was harmed because we got this issue wrong. And it stunned me because, as you know, the news has been coming out in the last week or so that immigration services have actually lost track of tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of children who came here unaccompanied and then were supposedly united with relatives. But the reality is we have lost them. They've been trafficked. They're doing forced labor. And that is the story that you tell at the beginning of your chapter. So just give us a recap of what some of these migrant children experience.
Yeah, so unfortunately, a law was put in place back in 2008 that entices unaccompanied children to cross the border as such, because it then promises immigration benefits once they are here. And once that law was passed, very predictably, the number of unaccompanied children drastically increased. And under this administration, the Biden-Harris administration, they have hit record numbers. In the 3.5 years, over 521,000 unaccompanied children have crossed the border. And the New York Times, no less, has written a series of articles on the conditions that these children then face, whether it is being sent off to quote-unquote sponsors who are not vetted by the Department of Health and Human Services. So they themselves could be illegal aliens. They could be traffickers. They could have multiple unaccompanied children living with them, inappropriate sex combinations, inappropriate age combinations. And then these too many of these minors are then subjected to sex trafficking and or child labor violations, working early hours, long hours in dangerous conditions, not being able to go to school or missing some school. And it's just we passed laws on this over 100 years ago to protect children from such conditions. And yet this administration and the left seem perfectly fine returning to it. And yet when you call them on it or try to expose it, then, of course, they blame the greedy corporations. But it's their very policies that entice it.
Yeah, exactly. And your chapter does a great job of highlighting why our current immigration policies are bad for kids. And you'd zone in on two different groups of kids. Number one, the migrant kids themselves are being trafficked and victimized and abused, but also the overall economic impact and safety impact on America's children is also seriously, seriously harmed by this administration's current policies. So let me just read you some of the lies. As our listeners know, the template that I requested for all of our contributors was to start with a real life story of a child who was harmed and then explain the lies about your area of expertise and why those lies harm kids. So your first big lie about immigration is we need more immigration to support the economy. Why is that a lie?
Well, the left likes to claim that, well, the birth rate is down in the U.S., our population is decreasing, and therefore we need more immigration. Now, of course, the left pushes abortion. It is their idol, and they are not for family. They are not for marriage. So on one hand, they are pushing these very destructive policies to families, to marriage, to children being born, to our population. And yet they use it to justify more people coming here, including children. In addition, when you are flooding the U.S. with foreigners coming here at working age, then you are creating direct competition with American workers, American students, college students, high school students trying to apply to colleges to get jobs right out of colleges, but all the way up to later in people's careers. There have been plenty of, for example, high-tech, high-skilled American workers reporting how they have been replaced by foreign labor and, to add insult to injury, had to train their replacement. My colleague E.J. Antony, who is a labor economist expert, has reported many times that basically we have just swapped out in the past year American labor for foreign labor. So any job increases that there were for foreign labor, about 1.2, and meanwhile about 1.3 million Americans have lost jobs. So we're not increasing the pie. It is favoring one population at the expense of Americans.
Okay. Well, that's very clear. And I think pretty obvious to the naked eye for any of us who don't exist in ideology land and we really touch grass every now and then. Obviously, that's the case. Your second lie, and this one I think might be the most helpful, it was one of the most helpful to me, is border security and immigration enforcement are racist. Why is that a lie?
Well, there's nothing racist about protecting Americans. There's nothing racist about trying to protect the migrants themselves. During this administration, CBP has reported foreign nationals coming from about 180 countries. What race would that be? There's only 192 countries. So we're talking about the 85% or higher of the globe are coming here. So this is an old tripe that the left uses. They use it to cause division. They use it to deflect, to distract. But Americans aren't falling for it anymore. It's about the numbers. We're talking about 10.2 million illegal alien, inadmissible alien encounters during this Biden-Harris administration, plus another more than 2 million known gotaways, aliens who purposely evaded Border Patrol. So it's about the numbers. No country can sustain these numbers. And then on top of it, to provide welfare and so many benefits to illegal aliens at the expense of Americans.
Yeah, I saw a video of a very tearful woman talking about how she worked so hard to purchase a new truck for her business, and she scrimped and she saved and she bartered and she finally got this incredible truck. And then she got to the point where she couldn't sustain her business and she had to sell it, and she sold it to a migrant who was getting a government finance loan and didn't have to have any credit. And, you know, her toil, this black young business owner, she's like, I toiled And this guy's getting it handed to him, and he's not even here legally. I mean, it was so bitter. Your final lie is that the Biden administration and the Biden-Harris administration has created safe, orderly, and lawful pathways for migrants to come to the United States. Why is that a lie?
Well, the numbers of deaths, rapes of the migrants coming here defy the safe part of their lie. It is not safe for migrants, nor is it safe for Americans. The fentanyl that's coming over the border, killing 85,000 Americans each year, fentanyl poisonings, along with the crime that is coming. The number of convicted criminals that Customs and Border Protection is encountering is either doubling or tripling, depending on the location of where these criminal aliens are coming through. So certainly not safe. Lawful. The Biden administration is continuing to ignore the law, whether it is the Immigration and Nationality Act statute itself, but also separation of powers. So Secretary Mayorkas of Homeland Security is completely ignoring the role of Congress to make laws and to determine who gets immigration benefits and who doesn't. And the administrative state under Mayorkas and Biden and Harris are just simply handing out immigration benefits and work authorization by themselves in defiance of the law. So it's not lawful. Mm-hmm. And it certainly isn't orderly. I mean, as I spoke, the numbers, 10.2 million illegal alien encounters, millions more gotaways, that is not orderly. It isn't orderly for the legal immigrants who have come years before and are still waiting to have their applications adjudicated. It's not orderly for families who are trying to bring a family member here lawfully. It's not orderly for employers who are trying to lawfully bring an employee here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, what we required in our chapter breakout, this is, we're talking about pro-child politics, why every cultural, economic, and national issue is a matter of justice for children. And we're talking to Laura Reese, who authored our border security and immigration chapter. She's at the Heritage Foundation. She's been doing this, as she said, for about, you know, 3 decades. Woman knows what she's talking about. She's outlined the lies about border security and immigration, but then she also connects the dots between those lies and child victimization, both the victimization of children who are coming here through a very unsecured, disorderly process, but also the children of our country who then have to suffer with the reduced levels of economic success, with less secure and less safe neighborhoods as a result, and obviously economic prospects that are going to be dimmed because we are reducing their ability to get their own jobs and maybe forcing their parents out of the workplace. So then we talk about the truths, right? What are the truths about immigration and border security? And your truths are the exact opposite of the lie. I mean, the kind of things that they are saying about border security and immigration is the exact opposite of the truth. So your first truth, I'm just going to list your truths. And I'm going to let you talk about whichever one you feel like, really, if we really got this right, then we would be able to have a great secure border. So the truths are, unlimited immigration hurts America's economy. You made some of that case already. Truth number two, there's nothing racist about border security or immigration enforcement. Truth number three, the Biden-Harris administration's policies create dangerous, chaotic, and unlawful pathways for aliens to come to the United States. Feel free to talk about those truths and then maybe wrap up with a recommendation of what should we do differently? Like if we could talk to our two candidates for president, what would they do if they really wanted to secure our border?
Well, let me focus on the unaccompanied alien children and the avenue that they have. I talked earlier about them being enticed here because they receive immigration benefits once here. They receive easier and faster green cards, special juvenile visas, refugee-like protection, et cetera. And this goes back to a policy that a law that was passed by two California members of Congress, introduced by them in particular, Zoe Lofgren in the U.S. House of Representatives and Senator Dianne Feinstein. And anyone who read their bills could see that if they were to pass, these numbers would increase. More people would come unaccompanied because either the children themselves or their parents saw this as getting a foothold in the U.S. If I could just get my child across the border unaccompanied, they're going to get to stay. They're going to get immigration benefits. And then hopefully I can join them later in the U.S. And this has, as we talked about, really endangered children. The cartels completely control the border. No one is crossing that border without going through cartels. They routinely rape women and girls, if not outright murder them. And then that's not even the end of it. Once they get to the U.S., then they can be subjected to the trafficking and the child labor violations, you know, perhaps to pay off their smuggling loan to get here. So what needs to be done is acknowledge that this law that was passed in 2008, ironically named Enhancing Efforts to Combat Trafficking of Children, has been an abject failure. And that section of the law needs to be repealed. We need to take away the incentives of the immigration benefits to decrease the number of children. And then once, for those who are here or would continue to come here, reuniting them with their families where they can be safe back home. Also, this is a gaping hole for gang members to come in. Think MS-13 and other gang members who are often teens themselves, so they can cross unaccompanied and then go join.
I've got to jump in right here. We have to wrap up. But the bottom line is you need to get this book. You need to read Laura's chapter. It's filled with footnotes. She will not leave you wanting. She will direct you to more information. And this is an area where we have to defend kids.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to our final segment of the day. I hope that you enjoyed that conversation with Laura. I will tell you, as the editor of the book, Pro Child Politics, you know, we're working with 19 different authors, all absolute experts in their area. Knowledge base was not a problem, but I will tell you, Laura, you know, she is that incredible combination of expert and beautiful writer and a woman that has wicked footnotes. So if she said anything and you thought, is that true? Could that really be? Oh, when did that happen? You are going to get, I mean, she probably, in some sentences, there's 3 footnotes per sentence. And so you really are not going to get to the bottom of that issue just in a, you know, 15-minute radio interview. Grab the book, look at some of her sources, go check out her other work as well, because the reality is that we are in a place where we are victimizing children on a mass scale simply because of the way we are managing our border, and nobody should be okay with it. We're going to turn our attention now to some audience Q&A, which maybe this is my favorite part. Hard to say whether it is Bible time or incredible experts, but we do have some Q&A. And as always, I've got my training director, Jen Friesen, here to help us along. How you doing, Jen?
I'm doing great. Howdy, howdy, everybody. And if I can plug the podcast, we had Laura on the podcast as well, and yeah, there's so many things even I'd never thought about. Of course, when I'm talking to the experts, there's always things I've never thought about, but that's a nice longer form conversation. So more things to learn there. Are you ready to get stumped today, Katie?
Let's get ready to rumble, baby.
Okay. Question from Jess. I have shared with folks what I've learned from Them Before Us about a child having a right to both mom and dad. But some folks have told me that all the studies show that kids are fine with same-sex parents and that it doesn't make a difference. How should I respond to that?
Well, I understand why you're getting that kind of response when you talk about the importance of mothers and fathers, because there was an all-out campaign leading up, especially to Obergefell, the legalization of gay marriage in 2015, where there was a cadre of supposed researchers, I guess you can call them researchers, who were trying to prove that children did fine without a mother and father. And so they produced a variety of studies, some data sets that they then made into multiple different studies. So it's not like it's a giant, it's not like a new cohort every single time. Sometimes those studies were based on the same cohort. And miraculously, they all found that kids fared, quote unquote, no different or, quote unquote, even better if they were raised by two moms or two dads versus being raised by a heterosexual couple. So there's some big problems with that. And it boils down to they used very poor methodologies to come to those conclusions. I mean, there has been evaluations done on the outcomes of these studies, and they've seen that if you don't use random samples, which is kind of the industry standard, if you don't have longitudinal studies that take a snapshot of those children as they grow, if you're not using adequate controls, then overwhelmingly you find these kids are doing great. But once you actually employ the gold standard of the scientific method, what you find is these kids are suffering, especially emotionally. And Jen, I'm going to let you jump in here, but I'll say that we spend an entire chapter in our first book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. Chapter 6 is all about same-sex parenting. The first half of that chapter is deconstructing those bad studies. The last half of that chapter is looking at the good studies that actually show how children are harmed, and then exposing you to, you know, 20 stories of kids with LGBT parents who talk about how hard it was to grow up without a mom or a dad.
Yeah, the two best studies I go to on thembeforeus.com, the things I pull up the most, is I go to thembeforeus.com and I type in study the studies. And that's one of the articles that we put together that talks exactly what you're talking about. It looks at the different studies that often get highlighted and talks about the methods used. And, you know, when I'm talking to people on social media or just in my life, and you say things like, would a kid care at all if their mom or dad just died? And a random other adult who was super nice and caring and loving showed up. Would the kid not care at all? Of course, everyone says, yes, the kid would care. If you say, does it matter if the kid just goes home with any adult at the hospital? They're born and they go home with some loving adults. Does it matter at all? Do you want your kid coming home with you from the hospital? Everyone thinks you should get your kid when you leave the hospital after you have them, right? But then, like you say, we say this in the book and on the website, if you flip and you start talking about same-sex parents, all of a sudden, miraculously, the fact that a kid would miss their mom and dad just somehow disappears and it doesn't make any difference to them. And we just kind of, you know, on its face, it's not true, but we break down that data for everybody on the website in a few different articles.
Yeah, there's no reason for you to ever cower or worry if somebody says, oh, they fare no different. The answer is they fare extremely different. It's just that we had an awful lot of bias and political manipulation that was pushing one specific narrative for the sake of getting their own progressive agenda passed and imposed upon among the whole country. And so the good news is that the answers are there. It absolutely lines up with what God says in his word. It is reflected in his world. Kids do need their mother and father. They do fare best. Those are the two adults that are the most connected to, invested in, and protective of them. And when they lose one or both, even if they're raised by two loving women or two loving men or 10 loving women or 10 loving men, they will always miss out on the love of their mom or dad. And that is an injustice.
Mm-hmm. It's good. Okay. Another question from Daryl. Could it be ethical to donate sperm or eggs as long as you allow yourself to be known and you don't keep it anonymous?
Mm-hmm. This is probably the crux of the question when you're looking at what can immediately be done in the area of third-party reproduction. That is, using a third party to conceive a child. Let's say it's a married couple and it's a mother and father, and maybe the father does not have quality sperm. And so they go get a third party's sperm, or the woman is older and her egg quality is poor. They get the eggs of a third party, some other woman, or they use the third party womb, somebody else's womb, to gestate their child. Anytime you're using a third party, what you really are doing is you're foisting loss on children. And so you can look at this from the perspective of, well, this is helping adults. But anytime you're using a third party, somebody else's sperm, somebody else's egg, somebody else's womb, what you're really saying is this kid needs to sacrifice something that they deserve, want, and have a natural right to, so I can get what I want. And that doesn't work in the Christian worldview. That is always forcing the weak to sacrifice for the strong. Now, there are some countries, Australia, the UK, that have recently passed laws saying, you can't do this anonymously. If you're going to donate sperm or donate egg, you have to be able to be willing to be known by the child when they get to be age 18. You need to provide medical records. You need to be able to at least have your identity available to them. And that is amazingly a step in the right direction. And I say amazingly because it's crumbs. It's crumbs. These children deserve to be known and loved by their mother and father every day of their life, and to give them scraps of, you can know their identity and maybe your accurate medical history when you turn 18. It's ridiculous. It's an injustice. And so no, there is no way, known or unknown, altruistically or commercially, to hand over, in essence, your biological children in ways that are ethical. It is always going to cost the kids. It is always something we have to stand against.
If we heard a man just saying, you know, I have a bunch of kids and I only talk to them after they turn 18, that'd be pretty, I mean, we have a term for that. It's called being a deadbeat dad, right? You're like trying to avoid paying any child support until it's too late. And I've started, you know, I was joking with some people more, you know, anecdotally, where it's like, we've always been critical of deadbeat dads. But now when you call that deadbeat dad a sperm donor, and because he's getting paid to be a deadbeat dad, now suddenly it's altruistic and it's something to, that's admirable. It's not, because, yeah, for men or women, they think they're doing something kind. But like you're pointing out, the kid is the one who pays the price. The adult gets compensated and then doesn't have to think about it again. Well, the kid grows up without their mom or dad. So congratulations, you're okay with them being there, you know, when they're 18. They've missed out on so much of you that they've needed for like foundational, yeah, being a man or a woman, like foundational things, and they've missed out on you. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it can't be ethical.
If we're doing our job on this radio show, what you're going to notice is we understand adults suffer. We understand that they're dealing with difficult issues. If we're doing our job, we are forcing you to take your eyes and your attention off the adults and what they want, even if what they want is legitimate, even if they really have endured some suffering in their life, and we are forcing you to put your eyes on the children. If we succeed in our mission to put them before us, you are going to look at all of these different questions, all these different cultural matters, even every major political issue through the lens of, what about the kids? That is our goal here at Them Before Us Radio. We want you to prioritize kids.
All right. From Ashley, do you think the U.S. is walking back from the gender ideology craziness we've been experiencing, or will it keep getting worse?
Mm-hmm. I do think that we have hit peak trans. And, you know, it almost happened immediately after gay marriage was legalized. A lot of the work that we do at Them Before Us is international. We try to collaborate with and support small, especially small countries that are more traditional throughout the world. We're trying to fight back against the family redefinition machine. But they noticed something interesting, that the effort to undo their traditional concept of marriage is part and parcel with this LGBTQ agenda in things like schools and on social media and in library books and materials and documentaries and on social media and all of that. And they're very concerned about both. And they say to me, like, well, what are we supposed to do? How do we stand against this? And I say, you fight for traditional marriage. Because I'll tell you what, if gender does not matter in marriage, it does not matter anywhere. And that's what we saw. We saw Obergefell legalized in 2015. And immediately afterwards, we saw Bruce Jenner, now Caitlyn Jenner, splashed on the cover of Vanity Fair. We saw this massive push, right, to normalize men in women's sports and men in women's locker rooms. We saw the transing of the kids, you know, this huge spike in the number of gender clinics that existed and the children that were being referred to them. I mean, like, the whole trans thing, I would say, really peaked in the last couple of years. But then something happened. Those children who were permanently and irreparably harmed by the chemical and surgical alterations, even the social transitions that they went through, started speaking out and said, "You have wounded me for life." And then you had entire countries like the UK and several countries in Scandinavia that looked at the data and said, "We're not helping kids at all. These kids, their depression, anxiety, and suicide isn't improving. They just have the same problems, but now they have a mutilated body." So now we see several countries reversing their transgender policies. And I don't know if the detransitioners and the data is enough for the United States, but I'll tell you what is: the lawsuits. Doctors, organizations, medical organizations, even Planned Parenthood are being sued by children who are harmed through these technologies. So I do think that the madness is maybe not coming to an end, but at least starting to reverse.
I think too, with Elon taking over and reopening, you know, Twitter X to more free speech. And, you know, I've seen photos now of what happens to people that I was, you know, I wasn't Googling this. I'm not seeing this on any of the major news organizations. Of course, it's too gruesome to post anywhere. And seeing, when you're able to see some of these things, I think you can't unsee it, first of all. And you start, I think people who care about kids especially really start getting their back up. And like you're saying, the lawsuits and Chloe Cole and people like that speaking out and having a platform where I can see those videos and they're getting reshared and not just getting squished down. I do think it's starting to shift. And I think too, it's interesting how it's all one direction in the Biden administration. The number of men that have won awards for being the first woman to achieve some kind of role, it's always that direction. So you're even seeing kind of the strange bedfellows of the radical feminist movement who, I mean, they helped bring us here. So it's kind of, you know, whatever, but we'll take them. But they're starting to join our side too and coming, walking back a little bit because they're realizing, yeah, when you pretend women don't matter, then they don't matter.
It is honestly one of the most fundamental assaults on reality. I mean, maybe the only other overt denial of reality would be 2 + 2 = 5. But I mean, like, we're at that level of, you know, like gaslighting of the American public. And I think that people put up with it for a little while because we're nice. We don't want to hurt people's feelings. If we kind of have this live and let live mentality, but we very quickly realized not confronting these lies, it only goes one day. You know, when you blur the lines between male and female, it is women and it is children who pay the price 100% of the time. And certainly in our new book, Pro Child Politics, definitely in our work at Them Before Us, that is what we see. We see that when we get these fundamental questions wrong about biology, about marriage, about maleness, femaleness, what is life, when does it begin? If we fail to get those questions right, there is always a victim. And it is the victim who cannot speak up or advocate on their own behalf. Those victims are kids, unborn, just born, very young, even teens, right? And we, as the next generation of Christians, have got to come to their defense. Thanks for tuning in this week. We will see you next weekend.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.